talking about the hangout, which has been a lot of fun and quite productive, actually, for me, so I appreciate the invitation. I'm going to talk, with apologies to those who heard bits of this Saturday, about some work that I did with an ex-graduate student, or almost ex-player in Melnikov, and this is out somewhere. I don't remember the hex number, but I can find it if someone needs it. And so, outline of the talk about is going to be this. So, I'm going to motivate why I'm looking at gauge linear sigma models 10 years after I last did the same thing. I'm going to give an orbifold example in the tradition of these talks. I'm going to do in detail an example which is sort of selected to be complicated enough to show what I want to show, and hopefully simple enough that I can do it. I'm going to describe the gauge linear sigma model for this example and try to relate them. Because the relation is a little bit puzzling at first, and show how we can compute here the things we want to compute there, or some of the things. Then I'll bring and discuss what the Coulomb branch of this gauge linear sigma model is and what it might mean for us. And then, to the extent that I have time and you have the stomach for it, I can take you in gory, gruesome detail through an instanton sum in a high energy phase. And if not, hopefully, I won't have time, I'll just give you the answer. And then I'll explain what that's useful for. And the bottom line is probably going to be that it's not useful for much, but it's fun, which is good enough for me. Okay, so why am I looking at these models, linear sigma models? The recent motivation comes from the following list of things we want to do. Right, this is good for short people, I can move it all the way down. So what do we want? Well, what we want in the context that I'm discussing is we want to study Takam condensation in string theory. Takam condensation is a brilliant thing to do because, like all string theorists, what we want is we want to study Takam. The initial stages of the condensation of a tachyon is a localized tachyon, is a brilliant chance to study time evolution without worrying about back reaction. So tachyon condensation is probably going to be the first place we manage to understand time evolution. Those are localized. This is important, so I can decouple gravity in the limit. So we want to study localized tachyon condensates. And this has been done with some success for open string tachyons living on deep brains by using open string field theory technology. There's an idea that's a few years old by now that you can extend that idea by looking at closed string cases. So in closed string theories, you can find closed string theories with localized tachyons, and you can imagine studying their condensation. And the merit of these theories, aside from being yet another example, is that the closed string theories in question can be made eminently tractable, right? So we can generate theories with localized closed string tachyons by just studying orbifold models. And orbifolds are lovely because you compute all the correlators exactly, and so if we're ever going to figure anything out, this is the place to look. So you look at some orbifold, fixed point of some discrete action on a free theory. You can understand the spectrum, and if you pick your group gamma correctly so it doesn't sit in SUN, in general, there will be tachyons. So you can imagine studying their decay. Well, of course, we can calculate all the correlators, but these tachyons are generically twisted operators, and nobody can study their correlators. I mean, you can compute a few correlators, but actually studying their condensation is very complicated. Else we would have understood a lot more, you are assisted, or you have a chance at getting anywhere. So we have a tractable theory, and the picture is that we think that tachyon decay, the decay of these twisted sector closed string tachyons, is supposed to sort of resolve the singularity. And now this picture comes by looking at special cases. I can pick my orbifold so that my sigma model preserves at equals 2-2 supersymmetry at the orbifold. And if I do that, then I can find that the most relevant tachyons, the ones that will decay fastest and will at least hopefully dominate the decay, even for a generic perturbation, or I can fine-tune my perturbation and just pick out those, are chiral operators. So the most relevant tachyons are going to be chiral operators, and that means that their decay will preserve the supersymmetry throughout. And so I can use the constraints of supersymmetry to cut down my calculation to something more sensible. And it's from this point of view, sort of, I have to make another caveat. So I'm going to make a list of ones, and then eventually I'll get to what I can do in the traditional string theory way. And then I'll postulate that doing this is somehow useful for understanding that. And there's going to be a lot of hoping.
Sorry, just to make sure I'm following, the sense here is that the entire theory, even with the Orbital hole, preserves this 2-2 supersymmetry?
Yes, the entire theory on the world.
On the world.
In two dimensions, yes.
Okay.
What happens is if this is not an SUN, it's going to break the space-time supersymmetry, so tachyons are allowed. But these are space-time tachyons, which are relevant operators on the world.
Okay.
Or the zero modes are. Well, okay. Even so, studying time evolution is way beyond me. So here's my most hopeful statement, which certainly in this context I have to sort of cringe when I say. What I'm going to do is I can't study time evolution, so I'm going to take these tachyons and then I imagine condensing their zero modes, breaking conformal invariance, and following the Wroclaw renormalization group flow. So I'm going to use Wroclaw RG as a surrogate for time evolution. Now this is hard. Everybody knows that this can't be right because the world RG equations are first order and time evolution is a second order problem. So certainly at the Perimeter Institute, one should sort of hide this as soon as you write it. But in examples where we've managed to have some kind of a handle on the two things, we don't actually map the flows, but the endpoints are. And so one can hope that at least we're getting a handle on what the endpoint of tachyon decay is. So the picture that we're going to have is that we will turn on zero modes of these tachyons, get a non-conformal theory and watch it flow on the RG of the low energy and the world G. And the picture is going to be that if I really make a slight perturbation of the actual orbifold theory, then this, which contains the appropriate tachyon, of course not as a zero mode, then what is going to happen is that I'm going to get, sort of in real time, a growing bubble, if you want, of in the interior of which the theory looks like the smooth resolved theory. Far away outside, at least at finite times, it will look as the same way it looked before, because the perturbation hasn't reached there yet, and then there's going to be some crazy thing going on at the edges. And so what the RG flow can give me is what will be left over inside when the decay is passed. So this is the picture. And now that we're using RG, we're in good shape because for studying these theories with n equals 2-2 supersymmetry and the resolution of these orbifold singularities, we have a powerful tool. It turns out that the resolution of these orbifold singularities that is accomplished by turning on these chiral operators following the Wroclaw RG flow is toric. So the result is a toric resolution. Happens to be, or the resolutions can be given toric descriptions, and so you can apply all the technology from the old days of gauge linear signal models to study this. So the gauge linear signal model is a sort of supersymmetric abelian gauge theory that's a simple theory to study, and we can cook it up so that it has gauge theory in two dimensions, so it's asymptotically free of the ultraviolet. We can cook up a theory that quite easily that flows in the infrared to this orbifold conformal field theory. That's pretty straightforward to do. And we can, how much can you prove? It's pretty clear that this is what's going to happen. I'll show you that. And then one can imagine that if you want to study this flow down to some infrared fixed point or out to trivial fixed points, depending on how many tachyons we turn up, we can imagine making a small perturbation here. If the perturbation is small enough, then the flow will track. So this is the picture I'm going to adopt to do this. And now, so I started here. I ended up studying something much simpler. And then because I'm doing chiral operators, I can actually understand the RG flow of these, of the supersymmetric theory By studying the correlators of these chiral operators, these correlators of these chiral operators are almost our G-invariant in these theories. Now, of course, they can't be our G-invariant, they flow. But it'll turn out that, because of the supersymmetry, the flow is sort of trivial. It's just a scaling by our chart. And so I can compute our G-invariant quantities and then introduce the scaling by hand to track the entire RG flow. So I can work in the twisted topological theory and compute our G-invariants, which is great because then the calculation upstairs and downstairs is the same anyway. And then I can introduce the scaling by hand and tell myself that I'm tracking the flow. So this is going to be my gain. So actually, we're pretty lucky in that sense. Okay, so this is not none of this absolutely is my idea, or even Ilarion's idea. This process was started, in particular this application, but as we use it, is a follow-up on the work of Moore and Marknik, and later Moore with his student Parmachev, who did exactly this in particular sets of examples. And their conclusion was the following interesting thing. So what they studied was not the closed string correlators that I'm going to present, but they studied the spectrum of D-grains. And they looked at the spectrum of D-grains in an orbital fold, then they smoothed it using this normalization group flow. They looked at the spectrum of D-grains there, they noticed that they were different. And they asked, where did the extra D-grains vanish? What happened if you had a D-grain that's no longer allowed? What did the Kakan decay do to it? And what they showed in a really nice calculation is that, in fact, the gauge linear model acquires, in addition to what we call the Higgs branch, the thing that looks like the smoothed out a piece of its classical moduli space of vacua, that looks like the resolved orbital, it acquires extra vacua, Coulomb vacua. And we'll see those in a minute. And then if you study D-brains in these Coulomb vacua, they carry exactly the missing D-brain charges. Okay, now this seemed to us, so their conclusion is a remarkable one, right? What they're really telling you is the following, that if you start with an orbital that's non-space-time supersymmetric, you make a small perturbation, the Tachyon decays, you get a smooth orbital, but also some extra stuff, discrete vacuum, out there in the middle of nowhere. Your universe is somehow multifurcated, and some of your states go off into disconnected vacuum. This is very strange. And we thought it worth pursuing further, and it seemed that introducing the open strings was an unnecessary complication. We can take a look at all of this with closed string correlator, so that's what we're going to do. Okay, and what we're going to find as a first approximation is that in addition to carrying D-brain charges, there are closed string correlators that are carried, that sort of live on this Coulomb branches. So let me set that. Okay, so let me set up an example, which is going to be the example in which I'm going to work. And as I said, it's chosen sort of to try to satisfy the Goldilocks property. So the example is C3, our example. Okay, sorry, and if anybody has questions or comments or wants to tell me I'm off my rocker at any time, please. So our chosen example is going to be C3 mod C2n plus 1. And you have to choose the weights that act and then the notation common in the field. This is going to be 2, 2, 1. So 3 coordinates of C3 transform the weight 2, 2, and 1 under this. And indeed, this is a solvable, orbifold, supersymmetric conformal field theory. I can tell you all about its spectrum until you're blue in the face, and it has two chiral tachyons. The two chiral tachyons show up, for those who like to follow these things, in the first twisted sector. There's a tachyon that I'll call T1. In the first twisted sector, and its R charge is going to be 5 over 2n plus 1. And 2n plus 1 is going to be called n forever and ever. There's a lot of things look like 2n plus 1. And there's another tachyon in the n plus first twisted sector, I believe. And its R charge is n plus 3 over n. And both of these are numbers smaller than 1. And these generate, presumably, the chiral ring of the theory. And we can make calculations in the orbifold theory, as I said. We like orbifold theories. They're both chiral operators. And there are, just from the sort of free field description of these orbifolds, you can compute the chiral ring, the ring relations among these. And they turn out to be very straightforward. So I believe that here the relations are, let me see if I can get it straight. So if I take T1 to the n. So there, I have to, in order to write these relations, I have to imagine that there are three fake cohomology classes in C3 corresponding to x1, x2, and x3. I'll call them psi1, psi2, and psi3. First, there is no cohomology class corresponding to these. These would be represented by the chiral operators psi1, psi1 bar, but what shows up in these orbifold models is to get to sort of scale and look at the local theory of the orbifold, I'm going to scale all correlation functions so that the correlators of these guys, which look like they're one, disappear. Mm-hmm. Right, so there's a scaling that I'm going to do. I'll show it explicitly. And this, again, is not something I invented. It was, I think, Warren Martin actually straightened it out. So, for example, T1 to the n looks like psi1 squared, psi2 squared, psi3. There's a relation in the chiral ring. Okay, that should hold, and the other one is, I can write various forms of relations among these things. I don't remember what the next one is that I want to write. Where are they? Oh, I have them written down. I do want to write them down here. So this is one. Psi1 squared, psi2 squared, psi3. And the other one will be that if I take T2 squared, right, then I just think of this as sitting in the n plus 1 sector, and this turns out to be, psi1, psi2, and Psi3 times T1, I believe. That's right. T1 is some power. What I want is Psi3, sorry. This is Psi3 times T. Get these straight. Here we go. Psi3 times T1 is T2 squared. This is just adding mod 2 n plus 1. It's just that I'm confused. Okay, so these are my theory. This is the theory. It has two tachyons, and these are the relations that are supposed to be satisfied. And what I'd like to do is turn on expectation, sort of little expectation values, perturbations of the highest component of the things of which these are the lowest, superfield of which these are the lowest components, and watch the thing flow. So this is my problem, and the way I'm going to attack it is I'm going to, as advertised, write a gauge linear simple model, which at low energy will flow to this orbifold theory, and then I'll figure out what the perturbations are corresponding to T1 and T2, and then I'll compute correlators. Okay, so that's going to be the gain. And the gauge linear sigma model is going to have a U1 squared gauge group. Okay, so I'm going to have a U1 squared gauge group, and I'm going to have 5 chiral fields, and so everything is determined by this matrix of charges, the charges of my 5 fields under the 2 gauge symmetries, and these are my charges. So using this, I write an n equals 2 supersymmetric Lagrangian that includes both of these. And so this theory has, among its parameters, 2 Fayet-Yopoulos terms, since I have 2 U1s, coupling to this U1, coupling to that U1, so my Lagrangian includes what I'll call R1 sigma 1 plus R2 sigma 2, and I can complexify these with theta angles, integral d theta plus d theta bar minus this complex conjugate. This is the twisted superpotential that I introduce at tree level for this theory. And so it turns out, of course, that classically this is a conformal theory, it doesn't flow at all. That's not right. That's, this theory is asymptotically free. The gauge coupling, East Way, is dimensional. At high energies, it's a weakly coupled gauge theory. At low energies, it's going to flow to something. It'll turn out that what it's going to flow to, if I choose my R's correctly, is the orbifold theory. And I can show that it's easy to show how to, where, what that's going to do if I pick. So the space of classical vacuum in this theory is given by the vanishing of a scalar potential. And I should write the scalar potential as d1 squared plus d2 squared. And so d1 looks like phi 1 squared plus phi 2 squared plus phi 3 squared minus n phi 4 squared minus phi 5 squared and so on. So the sum of the charge times the square of the field. And minus phi 1. And d2 is phi 4 squared plus phi 3. And what you can see is that I can now look at the space of classical vacuum. And if I choose, oops, R1 and R1 to be negative and R2 to be negative and I put them in a particular code, then 5, 4, 5, 5 have to have non-zero expectation values. You can check from here that this breaks the U1 group into Z2N plus 1. And so these guys, classically, 5-4 and 5-5 get eaten by a super Higgs mechanism. They're out of the theory. These fields are massless. And what I have is three massless fields, mod Z2n plus 1, that acts on them with exactly the right weights. So the unbroken symmetry that acts not on this and not on this is Z2n plus 1 acting on these subgroups with exactly those weights. So over here, in the lower left-hand corner, is where I get the orbifold. So this is R1, R2 space. This diagram's going to mean something in a minute. And if I pick R1 and R2 to be way over here, then I'm getting the orbifold. And now, the beautiful thing is that within this theory, I can continuously vary R1 and R2. And I'm going to claim that varying R1 and R2 corresponds to condensing these factors. Okay? And so that you can see this, because if I choose R1 and R2 positive, and again, within the appropriate cone, we'll see that in a moment, then now the expectation value of these guys has to add up to doing something around zero. So I've excised the point by 1 equal phi 2 equal phi 3 equals 0 when R1 is positive. And I've replaced it with something, and this is exactly what you do when you blow up the singularity at the origin. You throw away the point where at the origin where the orbifold was, you replace it with something else. So this is a well understood process. This is a symplectic picture of the Kähler resolution that I'm doing over there. And over here on this side, I get the resolve. Now I can study the picture in a lot more detail. I can see that classically this theory is going to be singular whenever the R's are chosen, so that there's a solution to this that leaves one of these U1s unbroken. And we have a very nice classical physics understanding. In these vector multiplets lives a massless scalar sigma. The U1 is unbroken, sigma is massless, it has no potential, and field space decompactifies. And so you can figure out where there are going to be singularities, and then these singularities will occur on lines that will break up the field space, and the field space will break into nice cones, in each of which you get a particular description. And somewhere here is a picture of these cones. There they are. So this field space breaks up into four. These are parameter space breaks up into four cones, and in each of them, classically, I get a description. I can follow with the story I said, figure out what the beds are, figure out what the unbroken group is, and so on. And torically, we draw these toric diagrams. This means an unresolved orbifold. This means, essentially, that I've condensed one but not the other tachyons, so I've partially resolved the orbifold. This is another partial resolution here. And over here, in between these two lines, I've done a generic blow-up and resolved both condensed both tachyons. And so here is the fully resolved phase. Okay, so if I pick the R's in here, then I see that the space of classical vacuum is smooth. Okay, so how does this describe our G flow or tachyon decay? It doesn't classically, because classically, I would flow over here, and this is a conformal field theory. And classically, in this theory, R1 and R2 are parameters. So in the classical physics of this thing leads to this picture. At any point here is a classical fixed point. However, quantum effects in this theory ruin that. And What the quantum effects do, first thing that happens is you go and you compute a one-loop beta function where this, these parameters are. And this is a two-dimensional abelian gauge theory. The calculation is very easy. And the answer is that mu d by du of r a of mu, where a here could go from 1 to 2 in this theory, is actually equal to 1 over 2 pi, I guess, times the sum over I equals 1 to 5, all of these phi I chiral fields of QIA, the charge of the field I field under the eighth symmetry associated to R. And I've cleverly chosen my basis, so I'll call this number delta A, and I've cleverly chosen my theory so that delta 2 is 0, and delta 1 is 2 minus 1. So what that means is that quantum mechanically, R2 is still a parameter of my theory. And whatever the deformation coupling to R2, this guy, is an exactly marginal operator. Whereas this one is not, R1 flows, so this is a relevant operator. The deformation takes me a little bit away from R equals minus infinity. Notice that it's kind of a crazy place to put your deformation. My fixed point is at R equals minus infinity. It's nice to write these in terms of parameters QA, which are either minus 2 pi RA plus I theta A over 2 pi, oh, theta A, I've added the theta angle for the theories. And then this is the fixed point is now Q1 equals infinity. So in terms of Q1 inverse, right, is that
so does the beta function for R2 vanish to all orders?
Yes, these beta functions are exact. Yeah, you can figure that, compute that. It's because of a multiplier of anomalies calculation. The beta function is determined by R charges complete. So R2 is an exactly marginal operator, which you'd be hard put to see over there. So I have to give some explanation of where marginal operators come from.
What is the non-productive contributions to the non-productive?
There are none.
There are none, you know that?
No, yes. And from holomorphy and arguments, they can actually determine exactly what's going on. So the flow in this theory, our G flow in this theory, is very simple. In this space, I flow to the right. Okay, so I start the only ultraviolet. I flow far enough into the ultraviolet. I'm always in the orbital phase. That's the fixed point. Notice that no matter where you start, you end up in this cone. And then, depending on where you start, you either end up here or here. So there are two possible endpoints, which reflects the existence of this marginal operator. And there's going to be maybe some phase, what looks like a phase transition between them. Okay, so this is the classical picture, including the beta function. And now I understand why I can imagine that studying this theory, I will follow the decay of R, or the growth of R, and I will be able to see the resolution of the orbital. Okay, so in this theory, again, I'm going to eventually twist the theory and compute the chiral ring, and I'll show you how I compute it in a minute, but it's clear that the twisted chiral operators here that I have a chance of generating anything from are sigma 1 and sigma 2. These are my operators. And the funny thing is that they both seem to have R charge 1. Right? They can compute their R charge, and at least classically, they both have R charge 1. And so mapping these guys to those guys is a little bit tricky. And in particular, I have to explain why I have a marginal operator, so I have to make some give you some explanation of the relation between these two theories. So there's some linear relation between those sigmas. It'll turn out that this T1, so I should say, in this theory, the twisted chiral ring is indeed generated by sigma 1 and sigma 2. And associated to each chiral field here, I can build a sort of related twisted chiral operator, which is just a linear combination of these given by the charges. Okay, and these will turn out to be useful in what goes on. So define these operator things like the psi 1 over there would be sigma 1, psi 2 would be psi 3 would be sigma 1 plus sigma 2, etc. Okay, so I use these linear combinations, psi a, psi I is the sum on a q I a sigma a. And these are operators in a twisted chiral ring. And what I'm going to claim is going to happen is that indeed these two operators are going, these two combinations, linear combinations, are going to correspond to T1 and T2. So that's going to give me some linear map between these guys and the sigmas. That still doesn't explain the R charge, but remember I have this funny scaling. And so, in fact, what's going to happen is I'm going to have, T1 is going to be essentially the same as psi 4, and T2 is going to be essentially the same as psi 5, and those correlators, that's the way I'm going to compute correlators. But I said this guy is marginal, this guy certainly is not, and the reason is this funny scaling. There's a scaling I have to apply here and there, and these phis are related by the linear, see, the linear map from sigma to t gives me a linear map from the r's to whatever the coefficients are of the perturbation over there, I'll call it g's. And when I write this gives me, because that linear map has fractions in it, this gives me a map between the q's and the exponentiated couplings over here, which I call phi, which looks like q1 is phi 1 to the minus n phi 2 inverse. Note that setting these to 0, which is where I want to go, sets q1 to infinity, which is where the orbifold is, and q2 is phi 1 phi 2 to the minus 2 or something. And when I solve this for the phis in terms of q's, I see that phi, there's a multi-sheetedness because I have I'm at an orbifold point. So for example, phi 1 is q2, q1 to the minus 2, the minus 1 over n. So these coordinates are sort of orbifold coordinates, but these are living upstairs. And now, remembering that q1 flows, I can plug that in here and I can compute the r charge of this guy, given that the r charge of this guy is 1, and then it checks. So I can tell you that the marginal operator I saw is actually a rescaled version of this guy. And I can furthermore, in terms of these phis, tell you that this coupling is an RG invariant. So some crazy power of the polynomial, and the exponentiated couplings of these tachyons is invariant. Sounds weird, but then you remember that this theory is so trivial that flow just proceeds by R charge. So it makes a lot of sense that I can make combinations of powers of the couplings that are actually invariant. So nobody expects a marginal operator here, but it's there. It's hidden. Because you have to go to polar coordinates and you don't see it at the origin. So there's not a marginal deformation of the orbital theory, but as soon as you move away from the orbital, there's a marginal deformation. Okay, so that's one thing that I needed to explain. Okay, so now I want to use this theory to compute the ring, the Carvo ring structure. And again, the statement that I was making is, so what are the correlation functions that I want to study with closed string theory? Well, the correlation functions I want to study in this closed string theory are of a form. I said sigmas generate a chiral ring. I can see how to relate them to this. So I want to compute things like this, right? The correlation function of sigma A1 up to sigma AS. And these are twisted chiral fields. So I don't have to tell you where they live because the OPEs are non-singular or because I'm working in the twisted theory. And these correlation functions, again, in the topological theory, these are scale invariants. These are RG invariants. But because I know about ghost number violation, because I know the flow, so you can easily see that this will be non-zero by counting ghost number only if S minus 3 is equal to some number which I'll call N1 or N. It's minus n1 times n minus 2. That just says that the R charge of this can be absorbed by n instantons in the first group, which swallow that much R charge because that's the anomaly. So R charge is related in the topological twisted theory. R charge violation is related to the beta function. And in this case, when this is non-zero, then y is proportional to q to the n. And q1 to the end, and since I know the flow of q1, I can put in the mu dependence back at the end. So that's how I study RG flow from computing RG invariants. And so I want to compute these objects. Okay, so there is a procedure for calculating them, which as I threatened, I might show you later. But first, let me look again at the quantum modifications to the moduli space here. So what actually happens when I take quantum effects into account? Well, the thing that is allowed by quantum effects and that is very important is the existence of these Coulomb vacua. What are these Coulomb vacua? Well, as I said, in these vector multiplets that I didn't write down right here, the lowest component of this twisted chiral field is a scalar sigma. And one can imagine vacua not in high energy, not when this is a classical theory, not when the coupling is small, but when it's strongly coupled, one can look for vacua where these fields take on non-zero expectation values. And if these fields take on non-zero expectation values, then there's a term of the potential, which I haven't written down because the expectation values were zero, and also because I forgot, but anyway, there's a term like this, which comes from the kinetic term, the four sigma d term for these charged scalars, this is phi I, which tells me that up to now, as long as these phi I's have generic expectation values, the sigmas are all massive, and I didn't need to worry about them. They disappear. That's the Higgs mechanism. This, if you want, is just the n equals 2 piece of Higgs. But I can go the other way and give these expectation values and make these massive. The expectation values are large. These will be have high masses. And I'll be able to integrate them out semi-classically because it's an asymptotically free theory. If I integrate these out, I can do a one-loop calculation with an effective action for sigma. If effective action for sigma is well known, it leads to a modification to the twisted superpotential. And the modification is that all kinds of coefficients trying to get it right. This is a, you know, there's a notation issue because there's sigmas and sigmas. So this is a sum on A, and then sigma A, times the log of, there's all kinds of, there's a mu here. This is the base of the natural logarithm, which is just a normalization I picked for Q in a minute. Product I equals 1 to 5 over all the fields, 1 over E mu, sum on B, by B sigma B, all of that object divided by QA. So this E just refers to fixing that guy. And this is my new twisted superpotential, with including one loop effects from integrating out. From integrating out the at one loop these chiral fields. And in fact, this is an exact statement again, because you can see by holomorphy and anomaly matching that that's the only thing it could be. So if I have sigma back here, the behavior of the sigma fields is described by this. So is this the low energy behavior of the theory? Well, you can ask when this might be true. It's certainly not the high energy behavior of the theory. At high energy, I have free phis. So this is certainly not a valid approximation of high energy, but it could be at low energy. There are other places where it becomes relevant. In particular, remember that if I tune the R's here on these singular values, then there's a massless sigma. There's a sort of branch of flat direction in sigma, because one of the sigmas has no potential. When I go far out along that branch, this becomes valid, though I have to modify it a little bit, because only some of the phi's got a mass, whoever couples to that sigma. So I take this matrix up there, hit somewhere, and I figure out what the massive phi's are, I integrate them out, and I get pieces of that coming out. And it turns out that that tells me a lot about these singularities. In particular, it tells me that if, so I have a particular sigma star that is the unbroken symmetry, and if the sum over I of qi star is zero, then you see that the coefficient here of log sigma vanishes, right? Because, that's because I didn't do this right. Goes to the power of QIA. I think they know this, but I don't. So see, if you look at the sigma times log sigma, it's multiplying the sum of the charges. And if the sum of the charges is zero, then the modification, sigma log sigma at large sigma, doesn't happen. So there is no potential generated, and we get a real singularity. The theory is singular. On the other hand, if the sum of QI star is non-zero, then I generate a potential, the sigma becomes massive, it gets an expectation value of order e to the minus r, because solving the equation, I can solve the equation of motion, I'll show that in a minute. And there's no singularity, but there are isolated Coulomb vacua. They're called Coulomb, sort of misleadingly, because turning on an expectation value for sigma but not phi would not Higgs the theory, were it not the fact that in two dimensions there is no such thing as a photon or a Higgs mechanism. And so I can study these 1, 2, 3, 4 singularities. And I discovered that of them all, only one of them, that only one of them would actually expect the theory to be singular, and that's here. For Q near Q2 equals to 1, R2 equals 0, in fact, there's a finite shift that says it's Q2 equals a quarter, I expect the theory to be singular over here. I don't know if I drew that on the right side of the line. That Q2 equals a quarter, I expect a real singularity. So when I compute things, they should somehow divert to Q2 equals a quarter. So this part of this sort of continuous Coulomb branches coming down and touching the Higgs branch at a particular point is something we've known for a long time. It exists when delta is zero in these Calabi-Yau models that we study a lot. When delta is non-zero, I can also integrate out all the sigmas. And then I integrate all the phis, give the generic sigma of f, and get this equation, and I can study the equations of motion that follow from this, right? So these are the critical points of this. And the critical points of this occur when the product on I of I'll call this psi I, right? Psi I is this linear combination that appears right here. So the power of QIA is equal to QA. That's the simplification in this equation is the reason for those E's and mu's and stuff. Well, there's a mu that don't. So these are my classical equations. If I find supersymmetric solutions of this theory, they're going to be at these values of the sigmas, where the psi's are these linear combinations of sigma that I wrote up here. And again, you can see that there are two kinds of stories. If, in general, this is two equations in my example and two variables, there's isolated solutions. Two polynomial equations and two variables, there's isolated solutions. In Calabi-Yau cases, life is different. If all these are deltas are zero, all the sums of the charges are zero, these would be two homogeneous equations in two variables, and there would not be a solution, generically. But when there was, it would come in a family, in one parameter family. And then you'd say that the existence of a solution tells you values of Q for which this is singular. And that would sort of give you the discriminant, if you want, of the model. I'm interested in these isolated vectors that are solutions to these equations. I can write these equations here. Let me write them in a basis, so I can plug in the linear combinations, and I'm going to use a slightly different basis. I'm going to use a basis where I'm going to use lambda 1 and lambda 2, and lambda 1 is psi 4. I'm going to use lambda 1 as psi 4, lambda 2 is psi 5, and I'm going to write these relations in terms of those, and they look something like this, minus n to the minus 3, that's these fractions that show up. Should be Q1, lambda 1 would be n, lambda 2. And the other one looks like this. This is just reading off these relations directly. Looks like that. Note that this one, where the sum of the charges is 0, if I wrote it correctly, would be homogeneous, and this one is inhomogeneous, and so there's a mu, the delta sitting hiding here that I'm going to hide inside Q1. Okay, so these relations describe two things. One is, they describe the classical sigma vacuum, the Coulomb vacuum of this, the supersymmetric Coulomb vacuum of this model. And if I imagine for a moment that I have a theory living where these vacuum describe the low-energy physics. So imagine the theory actually lives in its Coulomb vacuum. So this is a bunch of, the solutions to these equations are a bunch of 2 times n minus 2, I believe, isolated points, right, with which the sigmas are massive. This is an isolated solution. This is a bunch of massive vacuum. If I have a topological theory with a bunch of isolated vacuum, and I want to compute a correlator, it's really pretty straightforward. Right? This correlator would become, the only thing it can be, well, I can replace in each of the vacuum this operator with the numerical value of the bed. That's all it can be. This should be a sum over all the vacuum, all the Coulomb vacuum. Well, there might be, so I'll label them by some A for the vacuum. There might be some coefficient times product of, and each of these has a value, like sigma A1, A, sigma AS, A. And that's all it can be, because I'm holding back. You have to take the expectation of it, right? Because these are massive. So if I could accept, the problem, my problem is that I don't know how to compute this thing, this density with which I should take, the sort of weight with which I should weigh these back. What's clear is that any such expectation value that I compute like this will satisfy sort of a set of recursion relations that follow from the fact that all of these guys solve these equations. Right, so I can think of these as relations among the correlators, essentially relations in the chiral ring, and they will turn out to determine the chiral ring. And if you look at them for a moment, they're sort of identical to these once you put in these scalings. So the Q's come from these phis. If you rewrite these equations and write those equations, they're exactly the same relation. So we have a consistent story. And now the question is, okay, so can I, what's left to do is to compute this thing and to show that indeed the correlators look like that. Okay? And for this, in what, 10 minutes, you don't get to do the gory mess of the calculation. Let me tell you about how I set up the calculation, and I'll show you what the answer is. And it's kind of cute. So in these twisted gauge linear sigma models, when I do an n equals 2, when I do the topological twisting, one of the nice things that happens in topological field theories is the path integral localizes on the q fixed points of the nilpotent charge, scalar charge that I have. And in these theories, these abelian theories, it's pretty easy to see to characterize these q fixed supersymmetric field configurations. And they turn out to be related to some nice algebraic objects. And so we can actually try to perform, and we can map the calculation here into sort of a tree-level calculation that turns out to being topological, that only receives instanton contributions, and we can compute the contributions of Wurmschild instantons, or in this case, gauge instantons, order by order in this cube. We can actually make the calculations explicitly, and I can show anybody who likes pain. And I can do this calculation. Now, so what I do is I end up writing I pick a particular phase, and the formula says the following: yA1 up to AS is a sum over all instantons, but it turns out that if R sits in a particular cone, then the only instantons that can make non-trivial contributions are those of the dual cone, so that the instanton number dotted in with the values of R is positive. You can see that otherwise there's just no supersymmetric solutions with those instanton numbers. And then Q1 to the N1, Q2 to the N2 is the instanton action. And then I have a technique, which is intersection theory on some moduli spaces, to compute a contribution at these instanton numbers. And we know how to do that. It turns into an intersection theory. You note that the following is true. So where is this calculation going to be useful? Well, let's see. So my correlators here have to satisfy this relation. Then I'll get Q1 to the m, actually, the way I wrote it, minus m. So m is the negative of n1. And I see that unless, except for some very low-lying correlators, I better be able to take negative n1. And certainly positive n1 is no use to me at all. That's when this coefficient is negative, then I'd be able to be stuck with correlators of negative 8 operators. Remember, S is the total degree of this in sigma. So I'm taking positive degrees. I better be able to take non-positive n1s. This tells you that, for example, in the geometric phase, right here, the resolved phase, I can't do an instanton calculation. The classical supersymmetric field configurations do not support these kind of correlators at all. However, it turns out that over here they do. I can draw figure out the dual cone, and I can make the calculation in this phase. So I do that calculation, and it turns out that the moduli spaces are very simple, they're projective spaces, and I have a very nice formula. Instead of using the sigmas, I'll again do a linear transformation, write the correlator for a bunch of lambda a's. And here they are. So the kind of the way you do this calculation turns out to be the following. So YA, I only have two A's, AB, N. So YAB is going to be the correlator of, I'm going to do, you only have two indices. I'm going to relabel them. It's going to be lambda 1 to the A, lambda 2 to the B. And the contribution at instant time number n turns out to be, it's a nice way to do this, there's some factor of n. That's 2, and I plug in lambda 1 to the a, lambda 2 to the b. These turn into intersection cohomology classes in this projective space that is the moduli space. There's some obstruction class I have to put in. And the bottom line is you take this monstrosity, expand it formally in powers of lambda 1 and lambda 2, and look for the piece that has lambda 1 to the n2 minus n1 and lambda 2 to the minus n1 minus 2 n2. If you add these up, you see that it satisfies this relation equals minus n1. This is my contribution. Okay, so now I want to sum them. And the key thing to do is, of course, how do you pick out of an expansion the piece with an appropriate power of lambda? Well, you do a contour integral with a weighted with an appropriate piece of lambda. So it's a discrete Fourier transform that I need to do. And so I do that, and I get a bunch of geometric series that I can sum, and I find at the end of the day, the following is true, that YAB, after summing over Q, can be written like as follows. A double contour integral to pick out the degrees of everybody. Lambda 1 to the A minus 1, lambda 2 to the B minus 1. There's some extra leftover stuff. Times 1 minus R2 inverse, this is the result of all these geometric series that I summed, where these objects are 1 and R2 are very fun objects. So R2, for example, is none other than minus n q2 lambda 1 inverse lambda 2 squared lambda 1 plus n plus 1 lambda 2 to the minus 1. And if you look, you see that R2 equals 1 is exactly the locus where this equation is satisfied. So by deforming the contour away from the origin, the lambda 2 integral will pick up exactly the residue around this thing. And the residue around this thing is exactly telling me to plug in the values where this is 1 is the same as satisfying this relation, and R1 will end up being the product of these that is exactly appropriate with the power Q1, Q2 to the n. And then you just multiply these and see what it has to be, so I won't write it down. So what I get is exactly the following nice thing. I started with my instanton sum. I wrote it just formally as a contour integral, just to pick up the values, then I tried to evaluate it. And when I try to evaluate it, lo and behold, it turns out that nothing else here makes a contribution to the residue except this guy and that guy. These guys tell me to precisely compute at the solutions to these objects. So exactly what I get, essentially, when I rewrite the residue is exactly a story like this. And I can tell you what FA is. And it turns out that FA has some very simple form. F turns out to just be a function of the lambdas. And it is, so I get exactly what I wanted, basically. It's written somewhere. It's some nice rational function in the lambdas. You plug that in and you get your answer. Here it is. Yeah, so this is minus m squared over n minus 2 times 2 lambda 1 plus lambda 2 into the minus 2 times 2 lambda 1 plus n plus 1 lambda 2 inverse. There. So first of all, it does actually localize. So what I'm doing is I'm starting with the instanton sum in this space, and I'm getting an answer that looks like sum over the Coulomb back here that I expect to dominate over here. Okay, so this is some kind of complementarity. I can make the calculation any way I want. The instanton sum converges, it so makes sense. You can see that it's sort of requiring the dual cone exactly makes it converge when the R's are in this value and this region. But then I can analytically continue. The correlation functions I get are all rational functions of Q. I can write them down. And I get this convergence over here. So there's one last puzzle that I didn't get a chance to ask about. It's not obvious. I said things should be singular if Q2 equals a quarter. But if you look at the dual cone, you can see that these functions that I write here, well, at least if n1 is not 0, so if s is big enough so that n is at least 1, are polynomials in Q2. They can't possibly have a singularity in Q2. And figuring out the ones with n1 equals 0 is kind of tricky, because those are not instanton moduli spaces. Those are just intersection theory on the orbifold. But the orbifold is not compact. It's a little tricky to define. Best way I have of defining them, actually, is by just extending using these relations, which they have to satisfy. As relations on the chiral ring, I can compute them. And it turns out that, indeed, the singular correlators that are singular at Q2 equal a quarter are the correlators with S equals 3. So lambda 1 cubed goes like 1 over 4 Q2 minus 1 squared. And I get this just by applying this recursion relations to the higher ones that I already have. So I find the necessary singularities. I find that here I can't carry correlators. The Higgs branch, the geometry, does not have any place for these chiral ring operators, but they live in the Coulomb branch. So this is a gauge linear signal model story. That makes a bit of a sort of roundabout way, but at the end of the day, we have a consistent picture. We can compute all of the correlators any way we want. You can ask what happens in these intermediate branches. So the picture, if you start over here, is that your flow takes you through this sort of partly resolved picture, and then you end up in the fully resolved model. And describing things here is kind of weird, because there are some instantons, but they're not enough to actually capture the correlators, and so presumably you have to sum over both kinds of objects. So this is the end of the story. What are the nice things? That's the discussion section. First of all, if you want, this is exactly what every mirror symmetry person always wanted to do. What did I do? I started out with the instanton sum, the exact calculation from the point of view of a nonlinear signal model on this resolved orbifold. And what did I end up with after playing around? I ended up with a residue calculation on a surface which is the vanishing of two partial derivatives of a twisted superpotential. That's a Grothendieck residue, and this is the Landau-Ginzburg answer. So it's, in a sense, if you wanted to define mirror symmetry for this non-compact object, this is a proof, and in fact, you can then map this to sort of Cori-Bopa-type variables. There's a way to introduce u's or y's, or whatever you want to call them, into this Lagrangian easily, and then see that that's exactly what we are doing. But I got it sort of without t-duality and without any needing to invoke t-duality on a plane or fixed points or whatever. I just honestly sum the instantons. One can imagine that if I had a model with a real mirror, an actual geometric mirror, then the fixed points here are not isolated, and maybe I'd have to introduce some gauge symmetry acting on the twisted fields, and life gets complicated. But so this is as close to what we always wanted to do in terms of proving mirror symmetry as I've come. Well, second time I've come this close. That's one. And then the question is, what did we learn about all these orbifolds, these Taplin kids? So what are there these sigma backfolds? And I think the answer there is kind of disappointing. I don't think I've taught you anything about Taplin kids. I've taught you how to compute things in the gauge linear signal model. I can compute the correlation functions of these tapions as well as you want. I can, because these are rational functions, I can compute them here and analytically continue there, and I can get the growth of everything. But as to the physics of these isolated vacuoles stuck out there, I think what's really going on, and this comes back to actually something I didn't need all this to go through. This was just for fun. I can compute the Whitman index of this theory, right? Classically, just from gauge theory, but it's an easy calculation, and it's non-zero. It's essentially equal, you can see, to the sum of the number of these isolated vacuoles, they turn out all of equals on. So there's an invariant, the Whitman index, and it's certainly true here, and it's equal, surprise, surprise, to what you get by computing the integral of the curvature over the orbifold. I know what curvature is focused at the orbifold. I know how to compute the Euler character. Okay, now I smooth the theory. What happened to the Whitman index? Well, if I can compute the Whitman index over here in sort of the smooth phase, if I try, the Whitman index is an invariant calculation. On the other hand, if I think of a smooth point in a Calabi-Yau space, the contribution of the Whitman index is zero. how did the Witten index change? Well, no surprise, I changed boundary conditions at infinity. I blew this thing up. By the time I get to the deep infrared, where I can recalculate something, in the deep infrared, the resolution went up to infinity, and the bubble, if you want, in background decay grew all the way, and now infinity has changed. Okay, so once you see that something as crude as the Witten index is changing, following these correlators is silly, you know the answer. If I compute, of course, over here I get a Witten index given by the curvature, if you want. In this phase, I get a Witten index given by calculating summing over these discrete instant time, discrete vacuum. I understand that in real space time for Tapkan decay, I don't need extra vacuum to fix the Witten index, the GLSM does, because it's a consistent theory all the time. But in real life Tapkan decay, where the extra contribution of the Witten index went is by changing field boundary conditions at infinity. So in some sense, what I want to say is that all these discrete vacuum, from the point of view of Tapkan decay, are somehow keeping track in a nice, simple theory like the gauged model, the linear model, of what would happen at the edge of the bubble. Right? As this bubble goes off to infinity, there's some degrees of freedom living there. In here, nothing's left. Way far out beyond the bubble, nothing has changed, but something lives on the edge where the fields are sort of changing. And this is somehow keeping track of at least the topological charges that are being carried off. The brain charges that Martin Parmachev figured out, these the contribution to the Witten index that we can keep track of, and they get carried off to infinity as the boundary conditions at infinity eventually change. So I don't think that the picture that said, take an orbifold and it will develop these extra discrete vacuum, I think that's actually false. I think what an orbifold will do is it will have a growing bubble if you actually let the tachyon decay. And if you try to remodel this with this RG flow, then there's a little warning note for people who try to simplify life too much. You have to be careful how you interpret what you see. So I don't think there's a picture that was put forward by Moore and collaborators that somehow, when I get to the low energy, I have a smooth version and some Coulomb vacuum. And so the orbifold theory is something sprouted extra stuff. I don't think this is ever really a description of the physics. What you have at every intermediate point is a little bit of smooth space, far away nothing's happened, and in the middle, something that in this picture is represented by the Coulomb vacuum. So that's the picture that I'd like to propose as happening. So at the end of the day, I mean, it boils down to very little in terms of space-time, but we have fun with linear models on this. That's all. Thanks.
Question?
Yeah. So I love that final picture you gave about the edge of the bubble and so forth, but is there a way to see directly from some of the calculation of these Coulomb vacuums for the edge of the bubble?
Well, you know, there was a lie way back here that's going to prevent me. And so the only answer is going to be for some of the people here to solve their problem. See, I was using space-time constant tachyons and then vents and then doing RG flow. If you could tell me how to relate that to time evolution, well, then a lot of things would happen. But among other, one small benefit would be this. At the moment I have, I mean, the map from here to there is on intuition and physical sort of sensibility. And that's what tells me that these Coulomb vacuum are on the edges of the bubble. I can't compute anything anymore.
Too bad. Or is there a way you could tell, just from some intuitive calculation here, assuming that they refer to the edge of the bubble, what properties they